Yes, so here we are, and we are on Synthesis of Yoga, Chapter 2, Self-Consecration, page 69. But first, a little short, quick meditation. Right? Who has a bell? Do you, Andrea, have a? You are muted.
Yes, you give
Okay.
us a sequence of reading first.
Yes, the sequence is Matteo, me, Geoffrey, Andrea, John Robert.
The Synthesis of Yoga, Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 2, Self-Consecration. All yoga is, in its nature, a new birth. It is a birth out of the ordinary, the mentalized material life of man, into a higher spiritual consciousness and a greater and diviner being. No yoga can be successfully undertaken and followed unless there is a strong awakening to the necessity of that larger spiritual experience. I'm sorry, existence. The soul that is called to this deep and vast inward change may arrive in different ways to the initial departure. It may come to it by its own natural development, which has been leading it unconsciously toward the awakening. It may reach it through the influence of a religion or the attraction of a philosophy. It may approach it by a slow illumination or leap to it by a sudden touch or shock. It may be pushed or led to it by the pressure of outward circumstances or by an inward necessity, by a single word that breaks the seals of the mind, or by a long reflection, by the distant example of one who has trod the path, or by contact and daily influence. According to the nature and the circumstances, the call will come.
But in whatever way it comes, there must be a decision of the mind and the will, and as its result, a complete and effective self-consecration. The acceptance of a new spiritual idea force, an upward orientation in the being, an illumination, a turning or conversion seized on by the will and the heart's aspiration. This is the momentous act which contains, as in a seed, all the results that the yoga has to give. The mere idea or intellectual seeking of something higher beyond, however strongly grasped by the mind's interest, is ineffective unless it is seized on by the heart as the one thing desirable and by the will as the one thing to be done. For truth of the spirit has not to be merely thought but to be lived, and to live it demands a unified single-mindedness of the being. So great a change as it contemplated by the yoga is not to be effected by a divided will or by a small portion of the energy or by a hesitating mind. He who seeks the divine must consecrate himself to God and to God only.
If the change comes suddenly and decisively by an overpowering influence, there is no further essential or lasting difficulty. The choice follows upon the thought or is simultaneous with it, and the self-consecration follows upon the choice. The feet are already set upon the path, even if they seem at first to wander uncertainly, and even though the path itself may be only obscurely seen, and the knowledge of the goal may be imperfect. The secret teacher, the inner guide, is already at work, though he may not yet manifest himself or may not yet appear in the person of his human representative. Whatever difficulties and hesitations may ensue, it cannot eventually prevail against the power of the experience that has turned the current of the life. The call, once decisive, stands. The thing that has been born cannot eventually be stifled. Even if the force of circumstances prevents a regular pursuit or a full practice or a full practical self-consecration from the first, still the mind has taken its bent and persists and returns with an ever-increasing effect upon its leading preoccupation. There is an ineluctable persistence of the inner being, and against it, circumstances are in the end powerless, and no weakness in the nature can for long be an obstacle.
But this is not always the manner of the commencement. The sadaka is often led gradually, and there's a long space between the first turning of the mind and the full ascent of the nature to the thing towards which it turns. There may at first be only a vivid intellectual interest, a forcible attraction towards the idea, and some imperfect form of practice. Or perhaps there is an effort not favored by the whole nature, a decision or a turn imposed by an intellectual influence or dictated by personal affection and admiration for someone who is himself consecrated and devoted to the highest. In such cases, a long period of preparation may be necessary before there comes the irrevocable consecration. And in some instances, it may not come. There may be some advance, there may be a strong effort, even much purification and many experiences other than those that are central or supreme. But the life will either be spent in preparation, or a certain stage having been reached, the mind, pushed by an insufficient driving force, may rest content at the limit of the effort possible to it. Or there may even be a recoil to the lower life, what is called in the ordinary parlance of yoga, a fall from the path. This lapse happens because there is a defect at the very center. The intellect has been interested, the heart attracted, the will has strung itself to the effort, but the whole nature has not been taken captive by the divine. It has only acquiesced in the interest, the attraction, or the endeavor. There has been an experiment, perhaps even an eager experiment, but not a total self-giving to an imperative need of the soul or to an unforsakable ideal. Even such imperfect yoga has not been wasted, for no upward effort is made in vain. Even if it fails in the present or arrives only at some preparatory stage or preliminary realization, it has yet determined the soul's future.
But if we desire to make the most of the opportunity that this life gives us, if we wish to respond adequately to the call we have received and to attain to the goal we have glimpsed, not merely advance a little towards it, it is essential that there should be an entire self-giving. The secret of success in yoga is to regard it not as one of the aims to be pursued in life. The secret of success in yoga is to regard it not as one of the aims to be pursued in life, but as the one and only aim. Not as an important part of life, but as the whole of life.
Sorry, have we gone around the horn? Yeah. And since yoga is in its essence a turning away from the ordinary material and animal life led by most men or from more mental but still limited way of living followed by the few to a greater spiritual life. Sorry, I'm lost in the sentence. And since yoga is in its essence a turning away from the ordinary material and animal life led by most men, or from the more mental but still limited way of living followed by the few to a greater spiritual life, to the way divine, every part of our energies that is given to the lower existence in the spirit of that existence is a contradiction of our aim and our self-dedication. On the other hand, every energy or activity that we can convert from its allegiance to the lower and dedicate to the service of the higher is so much gained on our road, so much taken from the powers that oppose our progress. If the difficulty of this wholesale conversion that is the source of all the stumblings in the path of yoga, it is the difficulty of this wholesale conversion that is the source of all the stumblings in the path of yoga. For our entire nature and its environment, all our personal and our universal self are full of habits and of influences that are opposed to our spiritual rebirth and work against the wholeheartedness of our endeavor. In a certain sense, we are nothing but a complex mass of mental, nervous, and physical habits held together by a few ruling ideas, desires, and associations. An amalgam of many small and repeating forces with a few major vibrations. What we propose in our yoga is nothing less than to break up the whole formation of our past and present, which makes up the ordinary material and mental man, and to create a new center of vision and a new universe of activities in ourselves, which shall constitute a divine humanity or a superhuman nature.
The first necessity is to dissolve that central phase and vision in the mind, which concentrated on its development and satisfaction and interests in the old externalized order of things. It is imperative to exchange the surface orientation for the deeper phase and vision which see only the divine and seek only after the divine. The next need is to compel all our lower being to pay homage to this new faith and greater vision. All our nature must make an interior surrender. It must offer itself every part and every movement to that which seems to the unregenerated sense mind so much less real than the material world and its objects. Our whole being, soul, mind, sense, heart, will, life, body, must consecrate all its energies so entirely and in such a way that it shall become a fit vehicle for the divine. This is no easy task, for everything in the world follows the fixed habit which is to it a law and resists a radical change. And no change can be more radical than the revolution attempted in the integral yoga. Everything in us has constantly to be called back to the central phase and will and vision. Every thought and impulse has to be reminded in the language of the Upanishads that is the divine Brahman and not this which men here adore. Every vital fiber has to be persuaded to accept an entire renunciation of all that hitherto represented to it its own existence. Mind has to cease to be mind and become brilliant with something beyond it. Life has to change into a thing vast and calm and intense and powerful that can no longer recognize its old, blind, eager, narrow self of petty impulse and desire. Even the body has to submit to a mutation and be no longer the clamorous animal or the impeding clod it now is, but become instead a conscious servant and radiant instrument and living form of the spirit.
The difficulty of the task has led naturally to the pursuit of easy and trenchant solutions. It has generated and fixed deeply the tendency of religions and of schools of yoga to separate the life of the world from the inner life. The powers of this world and their actual activities, it is felt, either do not belong to God at all, or are for some obscure and puzzling cause, Maya or another, a dark contradiction of the divine truth. And on their own opposite side, the powers of the truth and their ideal activities are seen to belong to quite another plane of consciousness than that, obscure, ignorant, and perverse in its impulses and forces, on which the life of the earth is founded. There appears at once the antinomy of a bright and pure kingdom of God and a dark and impure kingdom of the devil. We feel the opposition of our crawling earthly birth and life to an exalted spiritual God consciousness. We become readily convinced of the incompatibility of life's subjection to Maya with the soul's concentration in pure Brahman existence. The easiest way is to turn away from all that belongs to the One and to retreat by a naked and precipitous ascent into the other. Thus arises the attraction, and it would seem the necessity of the principle of exclusive concentration, which plays so prominent a part in the specialized schools of yoga. For by that concentration, we can arrive through an uncompromising renunciation of the world at an entire self-consecration to the One on whom we concentrate. It is no longer incumbent on us to compel all the lower activities to the difficult recognition of a new and higher spiritual life, spiritualized life, and train them to be its agents or executive powers. It is enough to kill or quiet them and keep at most the few energies necessary on one side for the maintenance of the body and on the other for communion with the divine.
The very aim and conception of an integral yoga debars us from adopting this simple and strenuous high-pitched process. The hope of an integral transformation forbids us to take a shortcut or to make ourselves light for the race by throwing away our impediments. For we have set out to conquer all ourselves and the world for God. We are determined to give Him our becoming as well as our being, and not merely to bring the pure and naked spirit as a bare offering to remote and secret divinity in a distant heaven, or abolish all we are in the Holocaust to an immobile absolute. The divine that we adore is not only a remote extra cosmic reality, but a half veiled manifestation present and near to us here in this universe. Life is the field of a divine manifestation not yet complete. Here in life, on earth, in the body, Ihaiva, as the Upanishads insists, we have to unveil the Godhead. Here we must make its transcendent greatness, light, and sweetness real to our consciousness. Here possess, and as far as may be, express it. Life, then, we must accept in our yoga in order utterly to transmute it. We are forbidden to shrink from the difficulties that this acceptance may add to our struggle. Our compensation is that even if the path is more rugged, the effort more complex and bafflingly arduous, yet after a point, we gain an immense advantage. For once our minds are reasonably fixed in the central vision and our wills are on the whole converted to the single pursuit, life becomes our helper. Intent, vigilant, integrally conscious, we can take every detail of its forms and every incident of its movements as food for the sacrificial fire within us. Victorious in the struggle, we can compel Earth herself to be an aid towards our perfection and can enrich our realization with the booty torn from the powers that oppose us.
There is another direction in which the ordinary practice of yoga arrives at a helpful but narrowing simplification, which is denied to the sadhaka of the integral aim. The practice of yoga brings us face to face with the extraordinary complexity of our own being, the stimulating but also embarrassing multiplicity of our personality, the rich, endless confusion of nature. To the ordinary man who lives upon his own waking surface, ignorant of the self's depths and vastnesses behind the veil, his psychological existence is fairly simple. A small but clamorous company of desires, some imperative intellectual and aesthetic cravings, some tastes, a few ruling or prominent ideas amid a great current of unconnected or ill-connected and mostly trivial thoughts, a number of more or less imperative vital needs, alternations of physical health and disease, a scattered and inconsequent succession of joys and griefs, frequent minor disturbances and vicissitudes, and rarer strong searchings and upheavals of mind or body. And through it all, nature, partly with the aid of his thought and will, partly without or in spite of it, arranging these things in some rough practical fashion, some tolerable disorderly order. This is the material of his existence. The average human being, even now, is in his inward existence as crude and undeveloped as was the bygone primitive man in his outward life. But as soon as we go deep within ourselves, and yoga means a plunge into all the multiple profundities of the soul, we find ourselves subjectively, as man in his growth has found himself objectively, surrounded by a whole complex world which we have to know and to conquer.
The most disconcerting discovery is to find that every part of us, intellect, will, sense mind, nervous or desire self, the heart, the body, each has each, as it were, its own complex individuality and natural formation independent of the rest. It neither agrees with itself, nor with the others, nor with the representative ego, which is the shadow cast by some central and centralizing self on our superficial ignorance. We find that we are composed not of one, but many personalities, and each has its own demands and differing nature. Our being is a roughly constituted chaos into which we have to introduce the principle of a divine order. Moreover, we find that inwardly too, no less than outwardly, we are not alone in the world. The sharp separateness of our ego was no more than a strong imposition and delusion. We do not exist in ourselves. We do not really live apart in an inner privacy or solitude. Our mind is a receiving, developing, and modifying machine into which there is being constantly passed from moment to moment a ceaseless foreign flux, a streaming mass of disparate materials from above, from below, from outside. Much more than half our thoughts and feelings are not our own in the sense that they take from out of ourselves. Of hardly anything can it be said that is truly original in our nature or to our nature. A large part comes to us from others or from the environment, whether as raw material or as manufactured imports. But still, more largely, they come from universal nature here or from other worlds and planes and their beings and powers and influences. For we are overtopped and environed by other planes of consciousness, mind planes, life planes, subtle matter planes, from which our life and action here are fed or fed on, pressed, dominated, made use of for the manifestation of their forms and forces. The difficulty of our separate salvation is immensely increased by this complexity and manifold openness and subjection to the in-streaming energies of the universe. Of all this, we have to take account to deal with it, to know what is the secret stuff of our nature and its constituent and resultant motions, and to create in it, and to create in it all a divine center and a true harmony and luminous order.
In the ordinary path of yoga, the method used for dealing with these conflicting materials is direct and simple. One or another of the principal psychological forces in us is selected as our single means for attaining to the divine. The rest is quieted into inertia or left to starve in its smallness. The bhakta, seizing on the emotional forces of the being, the intense activities of the heart, abides concentrated in the love of God, gathered up as into a single one-pointed tongue of fire. He is indifferent to the activities of thought, throws behind him the impurities of the reason, cares nothing for the mind's thirst for knowledge. All the knowledge he needs is his face and the inspirations that well up from the All the knowledge he needs in his face and the inspirations that well up from a heart in communion with the divine. He has no use for any will to works that is not turned to the direct worship of the beloved or the service of the temple. The man of knowledge, self-confined by a deliberate choice to the force and activities of discriminative thought, finds release in the mind's hushed inward drawn endeavor. He concentrates on the idea of the self, succeeds by a subtle inner discernment in distinguishing its silent presence amid the veiling activities of nature, and through the perceptive idea arrives as a concrete spiritual experience. He is indifferent to the play of the emotions, deaf to the hunger call of passion, close to the activities of life. The more blessed he, the sooner they fall away from him and leave him free, still and mute, the eternal non-doer. The body is his stumbling block. The vital functions are his enemies. If their demands can be reduced to a minimum, that is his great good fortune. The endless difficulties that arise from the environing world are dismissed by erecting firmly against them a defense of outer physical and inner spiritual solitude. Safe behind the wall of inner silence, he remains impassive and untouched by the world and by others. To be alone with oneself or alone with the divine, to walk apart with God and his devotees, to entrench oneself in the single selfward endeavor of the mind or Godward passion of the heart is a trend of these yogas. The problem is solved by the excision of all but the one central difficulty which pursues the one chosen motive force. Into the midst of the dividing cause of our nature, the principle of an exclusive concentration comes sovereignly to our rescue.
But for the sadhaka of the integral yoga, this inner or this outer solitude can only be incidents or periods in his spiritual progress. Accepting life, he has to bear not only his own burden, but a great part of the world's burden too, along with it. As a continuation of his own sufficiently heavy load. Therefore, his yoga has much more of the nature of a battle than others. But this is not only an individual battle, it is a collective war waged over a considerable country. He has not only to conquer in himself the forces of egoistic falsehood and disorder, but to conquer them as representatives of the same adverse and inexhaustible forces of the world. Their representative character gives them a much more obstinate capacity of resistance, an almost endless right to recurrence. Often he finds that even after he has won persistently his own personal battle, he has still to win it over and over again in a seemingly interminable war, because his inner existence has already been so much enlarged that not only it contains his own being with its well-defined needs and experiences, but is in solidarity with the being of others, because in himself, he contains the universe.
Nor is the seeker of the integral fulfillment permitted to solve too arbitrarily even the conflict of his own inner members. He has to harmonize deliberate knowledge with unquestioning faith. He must conciliate the gentle soul of love with a formidable need of power. The passivity of the soul that lives content in transcendent calm has to be fused with the activity of the divine helper and the divine warrior. To him, as to all seekers of the spirit, there are offered for solution the oppositions of the reason, the clinging hold of the senses, the perturbations of the heart, the ambush of the desires, the clog of the physical body. But he has to deal in another fashion with their mutual and internal conflicts and their hindrance to his aim, for he must arrive at an infinitely more difficult perfection in the handling of all these rebel matter. Accepting them as instruments for the divine realization and manifestation, he has to convert their jangling discords, to enlighten their thick darknesses, to transfigure them separately and altogether, harmonizing them in themselves and with each other, integrally, omitting no grain or strand or vibration, leaving no iota of imperfection anywhere. An exclusive concentration, or even a succession of concentrations of that kind, can be in his complex work only a temporary convenience. It has to be abandoned as soon as its utility is over. An all-inclusive concentration is a difficult achievement towards which he must labor.
Concentration is indeed the first condition of any yoga, but it is an all-receiving concentration that is the very nature of the integral yoga. A separate, strong fixing of the thought, of the emotions, or of the will on a single idea, object, state, inner movement, or principle is no doubt a frequent need here also. But this is only a subsidiary helpful process. a wide, massive opening, a harmonized concentration of the whole being in all its parts and through all its powers upon the one who is the all, is the larger action of this yoga, without which it cannot achieve its purpose. For it is the consciousness that rests in the one and that acts in the all to which we aspire. It is this that we seek to impose on every element of our being and on every movement of our nature. This wide and concentrated totality is the essential character of the sadhana, and its character must determine its practice.
But even though the concentration of all the being on the divine is the character of the yoga, yet is our being too complex a thing to be taken up easily and at once, as if it were taking up the world in a pair of hands and set in its entirety to a single task. Man, in his effort at self-transcendence, has usually to seize on some one spring or some powerful leverage in the complicated machine that his nature is. This spring or lever he touches in preference to others and uses it to set the machine in motion towards the end that he has in view. In his choice, it is always nature itself that should be his guide, but here it must be nature at her highest and widest in him, not at her lowest or in some limiting movement. In her lower vital activities, it is desire that nature takes as her most powerful leverage. But the distinct character of man is that he is a mental being, not a merely vital creature. As he can use his thinking mind and will to restrain and correct his life impulses, so too he can bring in the action of a still higher luminous mentality aided by the deeper soul in him, the psychic being, and supersede by these greater and purer motive powers the domination of the vital and sensational force that we call desire. He can entirely master or persuade it and offer it up for transformation to its divine master. This higher mentality and this deeper soul, the psychic element in man, are the two grappling hooks by which the divine can lay hold upon his nature.
The higher mind in man is something other, loftier, purer, vaster, more powerful than the reason or logical intelligence. The animal is a vital and sensational being. Man, it is said, is distinguished from the animal by the possession of reason. But that is a very summary, a very imperfect and misleading account of the matter. For reason is only a particular and limited utilitarian and instrumental activity that proceeds from something much greater than itself, from a power that dwells in an ether more luminous, wider, illimitable. The true and ultimate, as distinguished from the immediate or intermediate importance of our observing, reasoning, inquiring, judging intelligence, is that it prepares the human being for the right reception and right action of a light from above, which must progressively replace in him the obscure light from below that guides the animal. The latter also has a rudimentary reason, a kind of thought, a soul, a will, and keen emotions, even though less developed. Its psychology is yet the same in kind as man's. But all these capacities in the animal are automatically moved and strictly limited, almost even constituted by the lower nervous being. All animal perceptions, sensibilities, activities are ruled by nervous and vital instincts, cravings, needs, satisfactions, of which the nexus is the life impulse and vital desire. Man too is bound, but less bound, to this automatism of the vital nature. Man can bring an enlightened will, an enlightened thought, and enlightened emotions to the difficult work of his self-development. He can more and more subject to these more conscious and reflecting guides the inferior function of desire. In proportion as he can thus master and enlighten his lower self, he is man and no longer an animal. When he can begin to replace desire altogether by a still greater enlightened thought and sight and will in touch with the infinite, consciously subjected to a diviner will, than his own, linked to a more universal and transcendent knowledge, he has commenced the ascent towards the Superman. He is on his upward march towards the divine.
It is then in the highest mind of thought and light and will, or it is in the inner heart of deepest feeling and emotion, that we must first center our consciousness, in either of them, or, if we are capable, in both together, and use that as our leverage to lift the nature wholly towards the divine. The concentration of an enlightened thought, will, and heart, turned in unison towards one vast goal of our knowledge, one luminous and infinite source of our action, one imperishable object of our emotion, is the starting point of the yoga. And the object of our seeking must be the very fount of the light which is growing in us, the very origin of the force which we are calling to move our members. Our one objective must be the divine himself, to whom, knowingly or unknowingly, something always aspires in our secret nature. There must be a large, many-sided, yet single concentration of the thought on the idea, the perception, the vision, the awakening touch, the soul's realization of the one divine. There must be a flaming concentration of the heart on the seeking of the all and eternal. And when once we have found him, a deep plunging and immersion in the possession and ecstasy of the all beautiful. There must be a strong and immovable concentration of the will on the attainment and fulfillment of all that the divine is, and a free and plastic opening of it to all that he intends to manifest in us. This is the triple way of the yoga.
So I would like to suggest we have a little pause. We read for almost an hour. We have almost as much still to go. And my mind is a little overwhelmed. Can we just like visit for a moment and then recoup, restart?
I think it's a good idea, Andrea.
Thank you. I need a break. I like it. I realize I really enjoy when we read one paragraph at a time and hang with it. This is really, it's almost too much. On and on and on and on. For me.
Well, I kind of like it for the globality, because we focused on the individual paragraphs, and now I'm getting a sense of how the text hangs together as a whole that I didn't get from the individual paragraphs. And I have to admit, I'm not really actually listening to it word for word the way I do when we read the paragraphs. I'm more just attending to the sense of it in a general way and not trying to hang on to every little piece. Otherwise, I'd be like you. My eyes would have faded out long ago. So.
Well, that makes perfect sense to me, Johnson. Yeah, in fact, my experience is also sometimes that I read, I get the sense of it, but if you ask me only a few minutes later to make a summary of it in detail, I would not be able to. I could only reflect the general sense. And sometimes really I get angry with myself. I say, why do I forget it? But I'm not sure that it's bad. Perhaps it's...
No, I think it's general the way sense. He writes. He writes this very, very dense writing, and it's extremely difficult to encapsulate it afterwards.
Yeah.
It has to be reread rather than encapsulated. So, yeah. I don't think it's you, Marco. I think we're all stuck with the problem.
Yeah. Absolutely. Fortunately, yeah.
I think breaks are important. I also think it's important to go through it. At least I like both styles. I like stopping and I like the continuity. There's things that I see with what we're doing, the way that we're doing it now. There's things that I see that I don't, that I can't synthesize when we go really slowly. I get benefit from all of it. But I also appreciate the call for a stop and a breather. I think that's important too. If any one of us is overwhelmed, certainly it's not a bad thing to just take a breather and say hello, turn off that part of whatever part of that mind that's doing whatever it's doing. I love Sri Aurobindo's writing style. I bathe in it. I attempt to experience it rather than understand it. So I'm not, I get put on the spot if I'm asked to paraphrase it. I'm not the best of paraphrasers. I'm like pinging off of different experiences as we're going through it and experiencing it in a different way every time we go through it, every time that I've gone through it. As I expect from my manifold self.
So it's very interesting. I think I have that experience of being with it more when we read more slowly through one paragraph. Whereas here, my mind seems to just be like, I gotta follow this. And it's exhausting. So I will see if I can kind of relax into it like you suggested, Jeffrey.
We only have 7 more pages. It's not, we don't have as much left as we're not at the halfway point. I'm pretty sure I haven't had it up. We're well over halfway. We started at 69 and we go to 88. So we've read 13 pages and we have 7 pages to go.
Good.
I found
okay.
First of all, I think there's an active way to read and a passive way to read. Active, you're really kind of digging in to all the each word and each article and so on, and passive where you're more just taking the overall, but I'm finding, like Mateo, that this reading through, while it requires a lot of concentration, I'm finding interesting relationships of it to my experience that I hadn't noticed before, that reinforce or correct or some of the things that I've been experiencing recently. So it's been very helpful.
people, like no joke, people thought that I was crazy when we started the Savitri immersion back in 2012, reading Savitri beginning to end in 4 days. I was confronted with a lot of people challenging the stupidity of that. No joke. And my response was always, there's no wrong way to do this. And when I can't concentrate on Savitri for 4 days, like that to me is would be a daunting task that I put in front of myself. So I just accept phasing in and out of it. However, there's things that I would start to see after doing that year in and year out. There's connections that I would start to make. That Jeffrey talks a bit about with the Veda that we're going through, braiding. So it's not just a style of reading, but it's also how Sri Aurobindo works. There's like this folding and weaving that gets wider and thinner and just kind of energetically vibrates around. And I especially feel that with the Veda and with Savitri. I feel that though with this style also. There's something about a style that I go in and out of really, really concentrated understanding of sentence structure. And then I phase in and out of that too. And I don't know, I forgive myself with that. I don't have any expectations of myself and my ability to comprehend or whatever. I don't even know what it is, but there's a lot to this. But thanks for calling for the stop, Andrea. I really, it is good.
I needed it. So are we ready to move along? Okay. But on that which as yet we know not, how shall we concentrate? And yet we cannot know the divine unless we have achieved this concentration of our being upon him. A concentration which culminates in a living realization and a constant sense of the presence of the One in ourselves and in all of which we are aware is what we mean in yoga by knowledge and the effort after knowledge. It is not enough to devote ourselves by the reading of scriptures or by the stress of philosophical reasoning to an intellectual understanding of the divine. For at the end of our long mental labor, as we might know all that has been said of the eternal, possess all that can be thought about the infinite, and yet we might not know him at all. This intellectual preparation can indeed be the first stage in a powerful yoga, but it is not indispensable. It is not a step which all need or can be called upon to take. Yoga would be impossible except for a very few of the intellectual figure of knowledge arrived at by the speculative or meditative reason Yoga would be impossible except for a very few if the intellectual figure of knowledge arrived at by the speculative or meditative reason were its indispensable condition or a binding preliminary. All that the light from above asks of us, that it may begin its work, is a call from the soul and a sufficient point of support in the mind. This support can be reached through an insistent idea of the divine in the thought, a corresponding will in the dynamic parts, an aspiration, a faith, a need in the heart. Any of these may lead or predominate if all cannot move in unison or in an equal rhythm. The idea may be and must in the beginning be inadequate. The aspiration may be narrow and imperfect. The faith poorly illumined, or even as not surely founded on the rock of knowledge, fluctuating, uncertain, easily diminished. Often even it may be extinguished and need to be lit again with difficulty like a torch in the windy paths. But if once there is a resolute self-consecration from deep within, if there is an awakening to the soul's call, these inadequate things can be a sufficient instrument for the divine purpose. Therefore, the wise have always been unwilling to limit man's avenues towards God. They would not shut against his entry even the narrowest portal, the lowest and darkest postern, the humblest wicket gate. Any name, any form, any symbol, any offering has been held to be sufficient if there is the consecration along with it. For the divine knows himself in the heart of the seeker and accepts the sacrifice.
But still, the greater and wider the moving idea force behind the consecration, the better for the seeker. His attainment is likely to be fuller and more ample. If we are to attempt an integral yoga, it will be as well to start with the idea of the divine that is itself integral. There should be an aspiration in the heart wide enough for a realization without any narrow limits. Not only should we avoid a sectarian religious outlook, but also all one-sided philosophical conceptions, which try to shut up the ineffable in a restricting mental formula. The dynamic conception or impelling sense with which our yoga can best set out would be naturally the idea, the sense of a conscious, all-embracing, but all-exceeding infinite. Our uplook must be to a free, all-powerful, perfect, and blissful one and oneness in which all beings move and live and through which all can meet and become one. This eternal will be at once personal and impersonal in his self-revelation and touch upon the soul. He is personal because he is the conscious divine, the infinite person, who casts some broken reflection of himself in the myriad divine and undivine personalities of the universe. He is impersonal because he appears to us as an infinite existence, consciousness, and ananda, and because he is the fount, base, and constituent of all existences and all energies, the very material of our being and mind and life and body, our spirit and our matter. The thought concentrating on him must not merely understand in an intellectual form that he exists or conceive of him as an abstraction, a logical necessity. It must become a seeing thought, able to meet him here as the inhabitant in all, realize him in ourselves, watch and take hold on the movement of his forces. He is the one existence. He is the original and universal delight that constitutes all things and exceeds them. He is the one infinite consciousness that composes all consciousnesses and informs all their movements. He is the one illimitable being who sustains all action and experience. His will guides the evolution of things towards their yet unrealized but inevitable aim and plenitude. To him, the heart can consecrate itself. Approach him as the Supreme Beloved, beat and move in him, as in a universal sweetness of love and a living sea of delight. For his is the secret joy that supports the soul in all its experiences and maintains even the errant ego in its ordeals and struggles till all sorrow and suffering shall cease. His is the love and the bliss of the infinite lover who is drawing all things by their own paths towards his happy oneness. On him the will can unalterably fix as the invisible power that guides and fulfills it as the source of its strength. In the impersonality, this actuating power is a self-illumined force that contains all results and calmly works until it accomplishes in the personality an all-wise and omnipotent master of the yoga whom nothing can prevent from leading it to its goal. This is the faith with which the seeker has to begin his seeking and endeavor. For in all his effort here, but most of all in his effort towards the unseen, mental man must perforce proceed by faith. When the realization comes, the faith divinely fulfilled and completed will be transformed into an eternal flame of knowledge.
Into all our endeavor upward, the lower element of desire will at first naturally enter. For what the enlightened will sees as the thing to be done and pursues as the crown to be conquered, what the heart embraces as the one thing delightful, that in us which feels itself limited and opposed, and because it is limited craves and struggles, will seek with the troubled passion of an egoistic desire. This craving life force or desire soul in us has to be accepted at first, but only in order that it may be transformed. Even from the very beginning, it has to be taught to renounce all other desires and to concentrate itself on the passion for the divine. This capital point gained, it has to be taught to desire not for its own separate sake, but for God in the world and for the divine in ourselves. It has to fix itself upon no personal spiritual gain, though of all possible spiritual gains, we are sure, but on the great work to be done in us and others, on the high coming manifestation, which is to be the glorious fulfillment of the divine in the world, on the truth that has to be sought and lived and enthroned forever. But last, most difficult for it, most difficult than to seek with the right object, it has to be taught to seek in the right manner. For it must learn to desire, not in its own egoistic way, but in the way of the divine. It must insist no longer, as the strong separative will always insists, on its own manner of fulfillment, its own dream of possession, its own idea of the right and the desirable. It must yearn to fulfill a larger and greater will and consent to wait upon a less interested and ignorant guidance. Thus trained, desire, that greater unquiet, harasser and troubler of man and cause of every kind of stumbling, will become fit to be transformed into its divine counterpart. For desire and passion too have their divine forms. There is a pure ecstasy of the soul seeking beyond all craving and grief. There is a will of Ananda that sits glorified in the possession of the supreme beatitudes.
When once the object of concentration has possessed and is possessed by the three master instruments, the thought, the heart, and the will, a consummation fully possible only when the desire soul in us has submitted to the divine law, the perfection of mind and life and body can be effectively fulfilled in our transmuted nature. This will be done not for the personal satisfaction of the ego, but that the whole may constitute a fit temple for the divine presence, a faultless instrument for the divine work. For that work can be truly performed only when the instrument, consecrated and perfected, has grown fit for a selfless action. And that will be when personal desire and egoism are abolished, but not the liberated individual. I read it again. For that work can be truly performed only when the instrument, consecrated and perfected, has grown fit for a selfless action. And that will be when personal desire and egoism are abolished, but not the liberated individual. Even when the little ego has been abolished, the true spiritual person can still remain and God's will and work and delight in him and the spiritual use of his perfection and fulfillment. Our works will then be divine and done divinely, our mind and life and will devoted to the divine, will be used to help fulfill in others and in the world that which has been first realized in ourselves. All that we can manifest of the embodied unity, love, freedom, strength, power, splendor, immortal joy, which is the goal of the spirit's terrestrial adventure.
The yoga must start with an effort, or at least a settled turn towards this total concentration. A constant and unfailing will of consecration in all ourselves to the Supreme is demanded of us. An offering of our whole being and our many-chambered nature to the Eternal, who is the All. The effective fullness of our concentration on the one thing needful to the exclusion of all else will be the measure of our self-consecration to the One who is alone desirable. But this exclusiveness will in the end exclude nothing except the falsehood of our way of seeing the world and our will's ignorance. For our concentration on the Eternal will be consummated by the mind when we see constantly the divine in itself and the divine in ourselves, but also the divine in all things and beings and happenings. It will be consummated by the heart when all emotion is summed up in the love of the divine in itself and for itself, but love too of the divine in all its beings and powers and personalities and forms in the universe. It will be consummated by the will when we feel and receive always the divine impulsion and accept that alone as our sole motive force. But this will mean that having slain to the last rebellious straggler the wandering impulses of the egoistic nature, we have universalized ourselves and can accept with a constant happy acceptance the one divining working in all things. This is the first fundamental siddhi of the integral yoga.
It is nothing less that is meant in the end when we speak of the absolute consecration of the individual to the divine. But this total fullness of concentration can only come by a constant progression when the long and difficult process of transforming desire out of existence is completed in an ungrudging measure. Perfect self-consecration implies perfect self-surrender.
For here, there are two movements with a transitional stage between them, two periods of this yoga. One of the process of surrender, the other of its crown and consequence. In the first, the individual prepares himself for the reception of the divine into his members. For all this first period, he has to work by means of the instruments of the lower nature, but aided more and more from above. But in the latter transitional stage of this movement, our personal and necessarily ignorant effort more and more dwindles, and a higher nature acts. The eternal Shakti descends into this limited form of mortality and progressively possesses and transmutes it. In the second period, the greater movement wholly replaces the formerly indispensable first action. But this can be done only when our self-surrender is complete. The ego person in us cannot transform itself by its own force or will or knowledge, or by any virtue of its own, into the nature of the divine. All it can do is to fit itself for the transformation and make more and more its surrender to that which it seeks to become. As long as the ego is at work in us, our personal action is and must always be in its nature a part of the lower grades of existence. It is obscure or half enlightened, limited in its field, very partially effective in its power. If a spiritual transformation, not a mere illumining modification of our nature, is to be done at all, we must call in the divine Shakti to effect that miraculous work in the individual. For she alone has the needed force, decisive, all-wise, and illimitable. But the entire substitution of the divine for the human personal action is not at once entirely possible. All interference from below that would falsify the truth of the superior action must first be inhibited or rendered impotent, and it must be done by our own free choice. A continual and always repeated refusal of the impulsions and falsehoods of the lower nature is asked from us, and an insistent support to the truth as it grows in our parts. For the progressive settling into our nature and final perfection of the incoming informing light, purity and power needs for its development and sustenance our free acceptance of it and our stubborn rejection of all that is contrary to it, inferior or incompatible.
In the first movement of self-preparation, the period of personal effort, the method we have to use is this concentration of the whole being on the divine that it seeks, and as its corollary, this constant rejection throwing out, catharsis of all that is not the true truth of the divine, an entire consecration of all that we are, think, feel, and do will be the result of this persistence. This consecration in its turn must culminate in an integral self-giving to the highest, for its crown and sign of completion is the whole nature's all-comprehending absolute surrender. In the second stage of the yoga, transitional between the human and the divine working, there will supervene an increasing purified and vigilant passivity, a more and more luminous divine response to the divine force, but not to any other. And there will be, as a result, the growing inrush of a great and conscious, miraculous working from above. In the last period, there is no effort at all, no set method, no fixed sadhana. The place of endeavor and tapasya will be taken by a natural, simple, powerful, and happy disclosing of the flower of the divine out of the bud of a purified and perfected terrestrial nature. These are the natural successions of the action of the yoga.
These movements are indeed not always or absolutely arranged in a strict succession to each other. The second stage begins in part before the first is completed. The first continues in part until the second is perfected. The last divine working can manifest from time to time as a promise before it is finally settled and normal to the nature. Always, too, there is something higher and greater than the individual which leads him even in his personal labor and endeavor. Often he may become and remain for a time wholly conscious, even in parts of his beings, of his being, permanently conscious of his greater leading behind the veil, and that may happen long before his whole nature has been purified in all its parts from the lower indirect control. Even he may be thus conscious from the beginning. His mind and heart, if not his other members, may respond to that seizing and penetrating guidance with a certain initial completeness from the very steps of the yoga. But it is a constant and complete and uniform action of the great direct control that more and more distinguishes the transitional stage as it proceeds and draws to its close. This predominance of a greater diviner leading, not personal to ourselves, indicates the nature's increasing ripeness for a total spiritual transformation. It is the unmistakable sign that the self-consecration has not only been accepted in principle, but is fulfilled in act and power. The Supreme has laid his luminous hand upon a chosen human vessel of his miraculous light and power and Ananda. So, we made it. We went through this chapter. It was an overdose of Sri Aurobindo and interior yoga. It will take some time for me to digest it.
I think, and a year end it again. A year end exercise too, right? This is the last one of the year, so
yeah. Yeah, in fact, these readings are called Synthesis of Yoga Practicum. So the question is, what is the message for our practicum? Because I think this is the first chapter, which is, well, you find something also in the other chapters, but this is the first chapter which is very focused on the practical aspect and not on the theoretical aspects. He speaks of consecration, of sacrifice, aspiration, concentration, surrender. Yeah, but what does it mean practically in our life, in our daily life? That's a big question.
I love the last line. The Supreme has laid his luminous hand upon the chosen human vessel of his miraculous light and power and Ananda. That is the promise.
The work, the mother, also ends with the word Ananda. There's a number of times where Sri Aurobindo will end something with the word Ananda. Pretty blissful.
I'd just like to thank all of you for your participation with me in this. I mean, it's really kind of seems to me really remarkable. I don't even know what it is. I don't know what word to call it, but it's a journey. We're going through this together, and it seems really challenging and calls for a lot to go through it with enthusiasm, not just a slog. So I want to thank you that I can be in your company as we go through this together.
Well, I think the thank you and appreciation goes in all directions. Love each one of every one of you here and be with you. And we continue.
Yeah, well, we kind of get hooked, don't we, on this stuff? So,
There is that. One of our beloved members said in one of the retreats at the ashram in Lodi one time, I don't know if I should put this on the tape or not.
She just said, don't mention any names.
I won't. She said, once Sri Aurobindo and Mother get a hold of you, you're fucked.
I think exactly who that was.
That's absolutely true. I mean, a very common experience, I think.
I kind of think we need a meditation to finish off today. Yeah. I'm not sure we're finished, but.
Yeah, I feel like putting in a little invocation for this, for the return of the light at this time in each one of us and in our world. We need it.
Happy holidays and Happy New Year to everybody.
Yes, yes.
Yes. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Mm-hmm. Happy holidays. I like that.
Happy holy days.
That's nice. Thank you.
Bye, everyone.
Bye bye.
See you in a new year. Mm-hmm.